Hi, it's Mountain Edition. All the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Sevry.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. This week, students at Aspen Middle School have a thing or two to say about gun control.
Garfield County met with RAFTA to discuss getting bus service down to Parachute and Battlement Mesa.
We meet Soren West, who hiked the Appalachian Trail at age 75.
And is Governor John Hickenlooper running for president?
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition. The Wild and Scenic Film Festival returns to the Wheeler Opera House this evening. It showcases 13 short films about environmental issues.
The theme of the 2018 festival is groundswell, and organizers say the goal is to bring communities together in a spirit of healing. The films include award winners like Letter to Congress, which uses environmentalist Wallace Stegner's words and sweeping images of the natural world.
Without any remaining wilderness, we are committed wholly, without chance for even momentary reflection and rest, to a headlong drive into our technological termite life.
The 13 shorts aim to cover a wide range of human and environmental topics, including food systems, recreation, and climate change. Aspen Center for Environmental Studies is partnering with Patagonia Snowmass to host the festival. ACES says both organizations work to inspire activism. The Garfield County Commissioners met with RAFTA Tuesday to discuss a bus service to Parachute and Battlement Mesa. There's concern the west side of the county is being left behind for lack of public transportation.
Currently, RAFTA goes as far as Rifle. The commissioners wanted to know how much it would cost to extend the route 20 more miles down the road to Parachute. The answer is a lot, like almost double. So RAFTA presented a cheaper possibility too, a shuttle service between Battlement Mesa and Rifle. The commissioner said they needed to meet with the different communities involved to gauge need and interest. Commissioner Tom Jankowski expressed concern that workers in these communities are at a disadvantage without reliable public transit.
A new study shows the arts contribute over $13 billion to Colorado's economy every year. Kristen Kay reports.
The U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis partnered with the National Endowment for the Arts to conduct the study. They researched the impact of the arts on employment and the value that they add to the economy. They attributed over 100,000 jobs to creative industries. Nancy Lovendahl, member of the Basalt Public Arts Commission, isn't surprised by those numbers.
Let's say someone is coming to the Art Base or the Temporary for an event. No matter what their ticket cost is, they're going to spend, on average, around $36 per person.
Some of the fastest-growing industries are web design, performing arts, and architectural services, according to the report. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
As spring approaches and fire season returns, public lands managers have released plans for prescribed burns.
Several federal and state agencies work together to identify areas that could benefit from controlled fires. There are three potential sites in Garfield County and two in each Pitkin and Eagle counties for a total of nearly 10,000 acres. Prescribed fire is used to improve habitat and vegetation for wildlife as they transition from winter to summer range. Officials say new growth can benefit wildlife as soon as 10 days after a controlled burn. It can also reduce hazardous fuels that pose wildfire danger.
Soren West hiked the Appalachian Trail in 2016. Impressive, but not that unusual, except West did it at age 75. Kristen Kay reports.
Soren West first dreamed of hiking the Appalachian Trail when he was a freshman in high school. That dream stayed in the back of his mind for the next 60 years. Finally, his family pushed him to fulfill it.
My youngest son said to me, "Dad, you better start the trail pretty soon or you're going to be the first guy to do it with a walker."
He knew he had the mental toughness to finish, despite physical setbacks along the way.
And I said, "I will amputate before I will not finish this trail."
West will speak about the journey and show his photography at the Temporary this evening. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Thank you.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. Elizabeth, if there's one thing we know about the loyal Mountain Edition listeners, it's that they want to stay informed about local news, right?
Absolutely. And one way of doing that is visiting Aspen Public Radio's Facebook page. While you're there, don't hesitate to like it.
There you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
This week, you can also hear about the financial woes of Crown Mountain Park in El Jebel.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook.
Crown Mountain Park in El Jebel says financially it's between a rock and a hard place. The park spans 120 acres and includes 12 soccer fields, a basketball court, 2 volleyball courts, 2 baseball fields, 4 tennis courts, a BMX bike track, and access to the Roaring Fork River. In May, it will look to its voters for help maintaining these amenities. Wyatt has the story.
Rolo, come! Come on! Come!
This woman brings her dogs to Crown Mountain Park a lot.
Most of the time, it's early morning running with one of my dogs or afternoon walks with all of them.
She lives in Willits, which is in the Crown Mountain Park and Recreation District. It's a special tax district stretching from El Jebel to Old Snowmass and as far east as Rudai. In mid-April, she'll get a ballot in the mail asking for higher taxes to keep Crown Mountain Park as is. The park might look fine now, but...
Here's a huge hole. We're getting this everywhere, and the grass is kind of... You can see it's kind of like deteriorating.
Rebecca Wagner is the park's executive director. She says they don't have enough money to repair or replace infrastructure. The park gets a lot of use.
So, you know, we'll see 300 to 400 people here on an evening. It's pretty incredible.
A lacrosse tournament in the spring brings in roughly 7,000 people. There's a big soccer tournament, a hot air balloon festival, a music festival. So why can't these people pay for the stuff the park needs?
It's pretty much impossible to do without pushing users out.
Even with higher user fees, they're still nowhere near footing the $1.6 million bill for a new 7-mile-long irrigation system. This is why the park is asking voters for $14 additional for every $100,000 of property value. If you own a $500,000 home, you would pay about $70 more in tax every year. This is not an easy sell for Mark Kwasinski.
Just because I love the park is not a good reason for me to support wildly opulent spending on things that don't need spending.
He lives in Basalt and comes to the park a lot. He doesn't see any problems.
And when I look at what we have, it looks like it's in really good condition.
Like the asphalt in the parking lot, which the tax would help touch up. The asphalt looks fine, Kwasinski says. And Rebecca Wagner totally agrees.
That's when you want to do it. You want to do it before you start seeing the potholes and the cracks.
One reason the park has lost financial footing is because of something called the Gallagher Amendment in the state's constitution. Basically, even though home values here are rising, a smaller and smaller percentage of their value is taxable.
The Gallagher Amendment definitely has an impact. I wouldn't say it's solely the result of the Gallagher Amendment.
Ken Marchetti is an accountant. He's been doing financial planning with Crown Mountain Park since 2002. He says another reason for the park's financial situation is that governing boards don't always do a good job anticipating future costs.
It's far cheaper in the long term to take care of what you have than it is to allow it to deteriorate.
And it falls on taxpayers down the line to keep making ends meet. Rebecca Wagner says if the tax doesn't pass this spring, the park isn't going anywhere.
We'll try to do as well as we can with the money we have and replace what we can.
But there is a cost to not paying up, she says.
The quality will go down. I already see it happening.
So now it's up to the community to decide what it's worth to them.
Colorado's Democratic-controlled House will soon debate whether to allow people who already have a handgun to conceal carry without a permit. The bill cleared the Republican-controlled Senate along party lines. As part of our weekly Capitol Conversation series, Benta Berkland talks to State House reporters about the annual gun policy debate under the Gold Dome.
Joining us today, we have Jesse Paul, a reporter for the Denver Post, and Marianne Goodland with Colorado Politics. This year, Democrats in the House have already defeated three Republican proposals to loosen gun restrictions. And Marianne, it seems like a pretty safe bet that this bill to conceal carry without a permit will fail in the House.
Absolutely true. We've seen bills like that in the past. The Democrats defeated it in the House last year. I don't expect anything to change this year. The bill recently cleared the Senate on a party line vote and is now headed to the House and certain defeat. One of the things that I found kind of interesting about this bill is that it doesn't have the support that I would have expected outside of this building. I was at a caucus Tuesday night, a GOP caucus, and one of the resolutions put forward by one of the precincts happened to be about this bill, and they voted to oppose the bill. It was like a two-thirds vote against the bill. And what these Republican members told me is that they like the training that a concealed carry permit requires.
Jesse, in some other states like Florida, we're starting to see some of the partisan divide on the gun issue fade just a little bit. I haven't seen that happen in Colorado yet too much.
Right. Republicans across the country in the wake of last month's high school shooting in South Florida have shown a little bit of willingness to hear out at least some of these pieces of gun legislation. And the Republican-controlled Florida legislature recently passed a gun control package that would raise the age of people seeking to buy rifles from 18 to 21, also create a delay period for people who are buying rifles. It would also open the door for some teachers and school employees in Florida to have guns on school campuses. We've seen all the way up to Donald Trump in the Oval Office softening his stance somewhat on guns being open to a bump stock ban. He's walked that back a little bit. That kind of softening stance among Republicans nationally has not been seen in Colorado. When we spoke to Republicans who lead the Senate about gun control, they showed almost no willingness to pass or approve any kind of Democratic gun control measures.
It also seems like Democrats are reticent. What happened last time after the Aurora Theater shooting, you ended up with two Democratic lawmakers successfully recalled when we passed the high-capacity magazine ban and universal background checks.
The other thing that I thought was interesting about that Florida package is that they also banned bump stocks. As Jesse said, the president supports that. And we had a bill here in the legislature to do the same thing, but it has virtually no chance of passage.
Why do you think that is? Is Colorado, what's different about what's happening here on the gun debate?
Because the Republicans in the state Senate, and the bill is in the Senate, have been just absolutely opposed to any kind of measure that would restrict anything to do with guns. The other thing is that the sponsor is a Democrat who was, before he was in the Senate, was part of New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's organization, Mayors Against Illegal Guns. Those two factors means this bill has no chance of getting out of the Senate this year.
It's also worth mentioning that Democrats in the House and the Senate, besides this bump stock bill to ban bump stocks, have not brought or introduced any kind of major gun control legislation. And that's despite at least one rally that we've had at the Capitol on activism from gun control groups like Moms Demand Action, who had a big showing here last week.
Thanks, Jesse Paul with the Denver Post, Marianne Goodland with Colorado Politics. I'm Benta Berkland, and this was Capitol Conversation.
On Tuesday of last week, Democrats and Republicans gathered to caucus. It's the first step in determining who will be on the ballot this November. Wyatt covered the caucuses and spoke with Carolyn Heldman about the beginning of election season.
Hi, Wyatt.
Hi.
So what happened on Tuesday?
So people gathered according to their precinct. Basically, Democrats gathered with their Democratic neighbors, Republicans with Republican neighbors. And what they did is they chose delegates from among themselves who will go on to represent the neighborhood at the county and state assemblies. And the delegates will cast votes for the candidates who are running.
Were there any results?
Yeah, there were, for the Democrats at least. In the Democratic caucuses, the delegates align themselves with a gubernatorial candidate. So statewide, we know that Kerry Kennedy, a former state treasurer, won big. That was the case in Garfield County's precincts, at least those that are between Carbondale and Parachute. In Pitkin County, Jared Polis picked up the most delegates. All this could change, though. At the county and state assemblies, the delegates could change their vote if they want to.
Hmm.
The Republican caucus is a little different. They don't conduct these straw polls, as they're called. So there aren't any results at this stage for the Republicans.
Why are we having caucuses when there's also a primary election scheduled for June?
The caucus is one way of getting on that primary ballot. The ballot that you will get in June, a lot of the candidates will have gotten on that ballot through the caucus system. The other way is you can go out and you can collect signatures on a petition. Caucusing is also about getting people together and getting psyched up for the election season. Bob Jenkins, who's the chair of the Pitkin County Republican Party, told me that parties at the caucuses are also doing things like selecting their election judges. It's kind of like getting in the locker room before a game and kind of getting a little pep talk with the coach or something like that.
So what else happens between now and the primary?
So in large part, it's now time for county assemblies. I say in large part because it's kind of different per county. The Pitkin County Republicans, for example, have already had their county assembly. All the delegates that were selected on Tuesday go to the county assembly, and then about half of them will go to the state assembly. And it's at the state assembly, that's the big cheese. That's where it's all decided. That's where people either get on the primary ballot or they don't. Candidates need to win 30% of the delegate count to get on the primary ballot. The state assembly is on the 13th and 14th of April for both Republicans and Democrats. This year, due to the passage of Proposition 108, unaffiliated voters will be able to cast their ballots in the Democratic or Republican primary election.
Thanks for all that.
You're welcome.
That's reporter Wyatt Orm speaking about the caucuses on Tuesday and what's next as we get into election season.
On Wednesday afternoon, students in Aspen took to the streets to advocate for stricter gun control. They joined a nationwide day of action, but instead of walking out of classes, they hosted a march after school in hopes the whole community would join. Elizabeth checked in with middle school activists who shared their thoughts on the national gun debate.
Yeah, we are trying to get
Jenny,
people to come.
I think Jenny's going to come.
Yeah, Jenny.
A handful of students are gathered in the Aspen Middle School art room after school, coloring, planning, and processing. When a gunman killed 17 people at a high school in Florida, it raised a lot of questions for them. And one big one. Bates Kirkulis is 10.
I just thought, why? Why would someone do something like that?
She imagines a future where no one is ever able to do that again. And for her, that means more gun control. Bates and her 12-year-old brother Felix are frustrated that more restrictions aren't already in place to prevent gun violence.
The whole government is just ignoring the fact that they can actually help this.
So Felix and Bates wanted to do something themselves. They saw that their cousin, who lives in Minnesota, was going to be part of a walkout on March 14th, 1 month after the tragedy in Parkland, Florida. They wanted to do something similar, and they weren't the only ones. Mia Wells is a seventh grader. She feels shaken every time she hears about a school shooting.
It's such like an innocent place, a school. But then again, it seems really like a hostile environment as well.
Mia, Felix, and Bates are all in different grades. They don't know each other that well, but they all have a desire to speak up about gun control and school safety. And they all turn to Assistant Principal Molly Tiernan for guidance and a little help planning.
I'm supporting our students to try and channel all of their energy into doing something positive, into giving them a voice. And so they came up with the idea of having a march.
The school is not sponsoring the march. It's happening after classes end today. Tiernan is here on her own time, too, because she says it's important that these kids feel empowered to take action.
It's turning into a student movement.
The students held an initial meeting to see who was interested, split up into committees, and got organized. One committee will spend lunch hours handing out postcards that kids can send to their elected officials. Another group is working on T-shirts. And of course, there's the march. The kids have invited their friends and families, made announcements on the PA system at school, and created tons of signs.
Enough is enough. More gun regulations now.
We may be little in size, but we are big in numbers.
Never forget.
More gun control, please.
Protect kids, not guns.
Elijah Goldman is an eighth grader who spent a long time stenciling those words in thick black lines across a white poster board. He, too, is working to understand what happened in Florida last month.
It just seems like common sense that there's no reason these guns should be on the streets.
And he has real expectations for what gun control laws should look like.
I think that it would be much safer if guns were limited to things where every time you shoot a round, it has to be reloaded.
Elijah and the others gathered here have a lot of ideas. make people pass difficult tests before they can buy a gun, raise the minimum age, have gun owners register the exact location of where they will keep their weapons, and definitely, they all agree, do not arm their teachers. Mia Wells says she just doesn't think guns belong in schools, and especially not around small children.
If a kindergarten teacher had a Glock in their classroom, I don't think that would be the safest thing.
So Mia, Elijah, Felix, Bates, and the others are taking their ideas to the streets, and they want the community to join them. Students will give speeches, which they've been preparing for more than a week. Still, Mia has tempered her expectations.
My goal is definitely to do something about it, but I don't think banning assault rifles is going to happen because one small town did a march.
It's a baby step, she says, but one that shows the students in Parkland, Florida, that the whole country is listening and standing alongside them.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orme.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. In other Aspen Public Radio news, the Aspen Art Museum is hosting a Wikipedia edit-a-thon today to get more female artists the recognition they deserve.
Below average snowpack is a concern in the Roaring Fork watershed, but it's not the only factor in spring runoff.
The Garfield County Commissioners okayed a zone change for a new polo club outside Carbondale this week.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
Author Luis Alberto Urrea was born in Tijuana and raised in California. He often writes about dual cultural experiences. His newest novel is The House of Broken Angels. Ahead of his visit to Aspen, he talked with arts reporter Kristen Kay about writing a novel rooted in his own life and heritage.
You have a new novel coming out, The House of Broken Angels.
It was inspired, sadly, by my own big brother's death. Three years ago, he passed away from cancer, but he knew that he was dying and had, I think, done the brilliant act of giving himself a last birthday party on Earth. And it turned into what I call the Mexican Finnegan's Wake, you know, with every kind of mad, wild person showing up to pay their respects. And I was just really lucky to watch it.
In the foreground of the novel, there's the De La Cruz family and their relationships and their conflicts.
Right.
In the background, there is racism, that incident where the woman interrupts a moment in a store between two characters to tell them they're going to be kicked
right.
out of the U.S. So
is
that how you'd characterize being Latino in the U.S., that there's kind of this background of racism constantly there that flares up?
Oh, yes. It doesn't go away. You know, it doesn't stop. I mean, I've experienced it myself, and it's funny because I was born in Tijuana, as you probably know, but my mother was from New York City, so I'm one of those Irish-looking Mexican guys, you know, and I grew up with a Mexican accent, speaking Spanish and English equally, and I had no idea that there was any kind of racial problem until we left a border adjacent ghetto area, you know, the hood, and moved to a white working class suburb where suddenly I was being called beaner and greaser and wetback. And I was flabbergasted. And I think as a survival tactic, without quite knowing it, I abandoned my father's Mexican accent and started speaking like my mom. You know, I thought the only way to survive is become more invisible. And it took me a little while to reconstitute my identity and own it.
Your characters are nuanced. They lead incredibly diverse lives. There's nobody in the book that's perfect.
Right.
And so they feel really real. And do you feel like that in some ways has become a political choice as an author in a time when there are so many stereotypes being thrown around.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that the best thing one can do as an author in this atmosphere, or let's say a Latino author in this atmosphere, is to subvert the dominant paradigm, as the old hippie bumper sticker used to say. And I really have been enamored by the experience of creating characters that I am trying to force readers to love in a way, especially people that a lot of readers look down on or detest. That moves me to do things like that because, you know, my motivation, I would say, is not necessarily political. I've said this before. I say it in Aspen all the time when I'm up there, but, you know, my motivations are theological. I believe in grace versus karma. I believe in the soul's journey toward whatever reward there is. And so that is always in my work. You know, it's motivated more by Thomas Merton than it is by, you know, the president or the Congress or the Senate.
Well, Luis, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks.
That was author Luis Alberto Urrea speaking with Edlis Neeson arts and culture reporter Kristen Kay. Urrea will be in Aspen on April 3rd as part of the Winter Words series.
Governor John Hickenlooper addressed the ongoing rumor that he's seriously considering a run for president. During a media briefing in his office on Tuesday, he said he had discussed the topic with his wife and son. Benta Berkland has more from the state capitol.
There are growing rumblings that Hickenlooper might seek the country's highest office. It's been the chatter in Colorado politics for months. Hickenlooper left the door open on Tuesday, but says talking about it publicly would be distracting.
There's not enough time to sit and worry about what's next. I have every confidence, as I always have, that if you work hard at what you're doing at this moment, then you will have choices down the road.
The governor has been working on a bipartisan health care proposal with Ohio Governor John Kasich, a Republican. The national media has speculated the two might run together on some type of unity ticket. In the past, Hickenlooper's tamped down that speculation. But previously, he has said he wasn't interested in being a vice presidential candidate and then turned up on Hillary Clinton's shortlist. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Wyatt Orme.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow for Valley Roundup at 3:30. Allison Bechtesh will be joined by a panel of local journalists who will discuss the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.